So the first of these lectures is roughly titled Quantum Spectral Curve for SU2 and hopefully SL2 spin chains. So is it big enough you can see? Okay. So I guess the first natural question you can ask is, what is a quantum spectral curve? And this is a question which does not have a particularly easy answer, but in sort of contemporary meaning, whenever anyone's, at least in our community, whenever anyone says the words quantum spectral curve, they almost universally refer to the quantum spectral curve, which appears in the context of, say, ADS CFT. So for N=4 super Young Mills, ABGM, and these types of things. But in actuality, a quantum spectral curve is a far more general object. So at least for me, if I say quantum spectral curve, what I mean is a modern formulation of the spectral problem of essentially any integrable system. Okay, so what I mean is I can formulate a quantum spectral curve for, of course, N=4 super Young Mills, which is the like main goal of these talks, but also for integrable spin chains like XXX, XXZ, and XYZ, and also something like the Sinch-Gordon theory or the KdV hierarchy of two-dimensional quantum field theories. Okay, so more concretely, a quantum spectral curve is actually what we call a QQ system. And I get told sometimes that my Qs actually look like Rs, but I assure you these are Qs. So a QQ system. And what is a QQ system? Well, it's a complex analysis problem for a set of functions, which we call QA, which depend on a single complex variable U. So this A is some multi-index, which will be specified later. And these Q functions live on some Riemann surface, which is specified by the given model in question. Okay. So we have a Riemann surface. Which is very model dependent. And functional relations which are more or less dictated by symmetry. So what I mean by this is that any integrable system which had the same symmetry, so for example, the integrable spin chain of PSU 2,2/4 and full N=4 super Young Mills will have a QQ system with the same set of functional relations, but very, very different analytic properties. Okay, so my main example to show all of this in practice will be SU2 invariant Heisenberg spin chain. And no doubt many of you will have seen this sort of this model treated many, many times using something like beta ansatz, coordinate beta ansatz, algebraic beta ansatz. But here I want to approach the thing directly from the point of view of QQ system. Okay.
So when you say that this is general, you have this formulation also for like Godin model or Calogero-Moser systems.
So for Godin model, yes, absolutely. For Calogero-Moser, well, I haven't seen this done explicitly, but I see no reason why not. So there was a paper, actually, were you on this paper with Gleb? You had something, like you had some sort of like Baxter equation. No? Okay. Okay. But yeah, I think in practice you can, yeah. What exactly it looks like, I can't tell you, but...
It was a honest question. I didn't want to promote the paper. I really don't know.
Okay. So let me just remind you about the physical setup of this thing. So we have some spin chain. So some one-dimensional circle lattice with some spins up and down. Say L particles. So this is 1, 2, up to L. And I have some really nice Hamiltonian, which is a sum of nearest neighbor densities. Which is given by with periodic boundary conditions. So we identify sites L plus 1 as 1. Okay, so this is the model.
To move it up, you should use the button.
Okay.
The middle button on top. Middle.
Oh, okay, I see.
And at front, yeah.
Okay, perfect. Well, maybe I want to go. Yeah, okay, let's do it like this. Okay. So what can we say about this model? So first of all, it has a global SU2 symmetry. So this Hamiltonian commutes with all of the global SU2 spin generators. And of course, what this means is that eigenspaces of this Hamiltonian correspond to irreducible representations of SU2. Okay, so if we have all of these spin 1/2 particles on our chain, say we have L particles, then each particle, say an electron, is sitting in, say, C2, and we have L copies along the chain, and this will decompose into some direct sum over irreducible representations labeled by some Young diagram, V lambda. Okay, and in this course, the simplest case of something with just two sites, we have the usual formula. Like this. So two spin 1/2 particles decompose into a symmetric tensor and a singlet. Okay. And I want to emphasize these symmetry properties, because when we go to look at N equals 4 super Young-Mills, having formulated the problem in this way in terms of irreducible representations will allow for sort of easy, or maybe not so much easy but natural generalization to n equals 4. Okay? So what happens? So we have all of these irreducible representations. So let's take some vector, say psi lambda, living in one of these irreducible representations. Let's take the highest weight vector. Which is killed by the global raising operator, and then the Hamiltonian should act on this with some energy related to whichever irreducible representation is acting on. Okay. So the usual way of solving this model, or perhaps, well, I would say historical, but it's still used. So let's just say usual. Is we pick some vacuum state. Which we just call zero, which is given by just taking the state on the spin chain with all spins pointing up. So what can we say about this state? So as is suggested by the notation, it has zero energy. And its spin eigenvalue in the z direction of the global spin z generator is given by L over 2. All right, so far? This you can just check by direct computation, right? I mean, this thing is spin up on each site. My global spin generator is a linear combination of spins, generators, and all sites. I just act on this vector, I get L over 2, because each site gives me 1/2. OK, and now I want to start flipping spins. So let's consider a state with S flipped spins. So say down, up. So to match Pedro's notation, S flipped spins down. So we're looking at states which will be some linear combination of these types of things with S spins flipped down. So an S magnon state. Okay, and this thing should be an eigenstate of the global spin generator with eigenvalue L over 2 minus S. Okay, because each time I flip, I lower my global spin by 1. So when I flipped, yes, I used the correct notation. So when I flip S guys, I lower my global spin by S. Okay. Okay, I think I want to go here. Okay, this display is a bit more complicated. Let's try.
You can make it the same as the other one. There is a button that makes that display equal to the other
one. Oh yeah, I found it. Okay. Okay, so we've talked about symmetry, we've talked about the different irreducible representations which can appear, and now we're going to talk about what the Q-system actually is for this thing and how the representation theory language feeds into that. Okay, so SU2 Q system, or QQ system. So some authors say QQ system, some say Q system, some say quantum spectral curve. It's all the same thing. So as I said before, on the first board, I have a collection of functions Q labeled by some index or multi-index A. So in the case at hand, I have three Q functions, Q1, Q2, and Q12 of U. Okay, and to help streamline the presentation a little bit, I want to introduce some very well used notation, which for some function f of a single complex variable, I want superscripts plus and minus, which just means I take my function and I shift the argument by plus or minus I over 2. Okay? Because in all of these formulas, I'll have upper index plus and minus everywhere, or shifts of I over 2 everywhere, and having this type of notation helps keep things a bit more compact. So for this SU2Q system, I have a single functional relation. Like I said here, I've got functional relations and then analytic properties. So this functional relation I have is just Q12 is equal to Q1 plus Q2 minus, minus Q2 plus Q1 minus. So as I said before, these relations will be totally general for some model based on, say, SL2 or SU2 or GL2, whatever you want. So XXX Heisenberg spin chain, XXZ, XYZ, with a little bit of like some limits taken, of course, Godin model, like Enrico was asking. So if all of these things have exactly the same set of relations, what singles out the Heisenberg XXX spin chain? And the answer comes in the precise analytic properties of the solutions to these relations.
Good question.
Yes.
I'm trying to remember the form of these equations, but is Q12 related to T for some transfer matrix or some representation?
Yeah, so this would be the spin chain, the transfer matrix in some Verma module. So I'm probably not going to emphasize the role of like the representation theory and like antidominantly shifted Yangian or any of these things, but yeah. Yeah, so indeed, I mean, this infinite dimensional representation sort of like decomposes into some finite piece and then some highest weight piece, and then somehow like the highest weight piece should be the thing which corresponds to this T you're talking about, if I remember correctly. Okay, so what are the analytic properties for the Heisenberg spin chain? For SU2. Well, they're very simple. First of all, we have what we call a boundary condition which just tells us that this Q12 is just given by U to the L, where L again is the length of the spin chain. Okay, so this thing doesn't depend on any states, it's just completely fixed to be U to the L for all states. And then second of all, we have that this Q1 of U and Q2 of U are both polynomial. And then there's a very nice theorem of completeness, which tells you that every solution of this system with these analytic properties is in one-to-one correspondence with eigenstates of this Hamiltonian, or equivalent to these SU2 irreducible representations. So one-to-one correspondence between solutions and these H eigenspaces. And to some extent, contrary to popular belief, this really is actually a theorem. Completeness has been proved, at least in the case of, say, SU2 or SUN. Fundamental representation spin chains, other supersymmetric analogs.
What determines that there are two independent Qs in this for SU2?
Right. So from this point of view, you would never see why there would be two. So the fact that there would be two comes from the fact that, as Pedro was discussing earlier in his talk, if you build all of these things as operators, which you can do in the language of quantum groups, you would see that there would be naturally two solutions. In fact, for like say an SUN, you would naturally see N. Essentially because these things come about by solving a finite difference equation, in this case of order two. So we see with second order differential equation, you expect two solutions. Here with second order difference equation, you would also get two solutions.
Here by completeness, you really mean with eigenspaces, therefore eigenvalues, not the completeness of the Hilbert space.
Right, no, I don't mean that. I mean completeness of solutions to this to eigenspaces of the Hamiltonian. Yes. Yes?
Is this like Wronskian condition for two solutions?
Yes, exactly. This is like quantum Wronskian, because I have these sort of extra, these shifts, which in some sort of classical limit would disappear. More questions? Okay, so we have these conditions, this statement of completeness. Now, how do we relate solutions to this thing, to the eigenspaces we had over here? So these eigenspaces were naturally labeled by some quantum numbers, right, related to the global spin value. So somehow this information should be obtainable from this QQ system if it is meant to describe, as I said, the complete space of Hamiltonian eigenstates. Yeah, maybe I can go here. Is there like a canonical order for moving between them?
No.
Okay. Let's see, this is mid, I want back. And we will need that visible. Actually, let's keep mid. Okay.
Could you say how you knew that was the right boundary condition?
Again, if I was to, like, it's the same answer to the previous question. If I was to construct all of these things as operators explicitly, then you would see that this, so for an irreducible representation, you would essentially read off. So for an irreducible representation, this operator, this guy who is now an operator, Q12, you would explicitly see to be proportional to the identity operator with eigenvalue then just U to the L. So I agree from the point of view of just me writing down these functional relations, everything seems a bit mysterious. But as I said earlier, in the case of at least like this sort of one loop problem, everything can be formulated rigorously at the level of operators. But when we go to say N equals 4 super Young-Mills at finite coupling, all we can do is write down these functional relations. We can't explicitly prove that these need to be what they are based on building operators because we don't know what the operators are. So how to map this? Was there a question? No. How to map this to this? So for this S Magnon state,
clarify or and to help people. I think you can derive this equation
starting from the Baxter equation.
Sure. If I start from Baxter, sure. But if I just going from what I have here, I mean, it's just postulated. But yeah, so I'm...
The consequence of the equation I wrote,
yes.
In that language, Q1 and Q2 would be two solutions
yes.
to Baxter.
Yeah, so I will...
Follows,
yeah.
Then this equation follows.
Yeah, from this point of view, yes, indeed it follows. And I will hopefully get to that and see it from that point of view as well. So for this S magnon state, what we have is, so this Q1 with some coefficient A1 is a polynomial of degree S. And this Q2 is a polynomial of degree U to the L minus S plus 1. And of course, since this thing is polynomial, we can factor it over its roots. UK, where these UK are precisely the beta roots from Pedro's talk. And how do I know this? So at the end, I'm going to take all of this and rederive the Baxter equation from Pedro's talk so that you can see sort of the self-consistency. And of course, doing what Pedro did earlier, we can write down a formula for the energy eigenstate, or energy eigenvalue, sorry. So log derivative Q1 of U plus I over 2, Q1 of U minus I over 2, and then evaluate at U equal to 0. And the question which comes up all the time is, what's special about Q1? Why couldn't I also use Q2 in this formula? Because I have Q1 and Q2, and they both seem to be on more or less equal footing. And of course, the answer is that you can. And you get exactly the same formula if you replace Q1 with Q2 in this thing as a consequence of this relation. OK, so there's nothing special about Q1.
I have a question.
Yes.
So in the SL2 case,
yes.
When we are continuing in spin,
yes.
There kind of is a preferred Q.
Yes.
Which is the one which decays asymptotically.
Yes.
We do not quite know how to extract the continuing in spin energy from the solutions that grow in U. Will you say that there should be a way of doing that as well? And that they should be same footing as other, or when you continue in spin, do you break this statement?
No, when you continue in spin, you absolutely break this. So, I mean, if you look at, so for example, here, it would be just because I'm doing SU2, everybody's polynomial, everybody is nice. Even if I go to say, continue to say spin minus 1/2, okay, so then I can still do highest weight representations, but now it's no longer the case that both of my functions will be polynomial, only one guy will be polynomial. And in fact, when we did separation of variables, it was sort of always natural to write everybody in terms of this one guy who is polynomial. And of course, if you analytically continue it to complex spin, where S becomes generically complex, and of course, in general, nobody is polynomial. But there was some paper, I think, with Kolya. Were you on this as well? With Volodya? Where they wrote down, you have Baxter for complex spin, and there's some preferred linear combination which makes the conformal dimension finite. Well, maybe it wasn't you. I guess it wasn't, you would know, right? Well, I'll mention this actually, I'll discuss this in a bit of detail in the third talk. When I sort of look at quantum spectral curve in full generality, analytically continuing complex spin, take spin small, and then look at some very explicit solution. So hopefully I'll be able to come back to the question in that talk. Any more questions? symmetries. So what kind of symmetries do we have? What can we do on these functions to preserve all of these relations? Well, this one relation and these analytic properties. Well, first of all, we have rescalings. OK, so we can take Q1 and rescale it by some number, say C, and take Q2 and rescale it by 1 over C. OK, why do I have to rescale this by 1 over C? Because I want to preserve this condition. So I know that Q12 is just U to the L. So the only way to preserve this relation is if I multiply Q1 by something, I have to multiply by Q2 by its inverse. So this is a symmetry of the system, which is very useful when you try to explicitly solve this thing, which we will do in a concrete example in a few minutes. And a further symmetry is gauge symmetry. OK, so for example, I can take Q2 and add to it any multiple of Q1, where this gamma is just a complex number. It's not a function, not a function of U. OK, so why can I do this? Well, you see that this relation, this Q12 equals Q1, Q2 minus Q2, Q1, is essentially a determinant relation. So if I add to Q2 any multiple of Q1 by the antisymmetry of this relation, the contribution is going to give me 0. OK, so now I want to explicitly solve the system.
Why it's called gauge symmetry?
It's called gauge symmetry because when you start from, say, the thermodynamic beta ansatz approach, which Pedro very briefly mentioned earlier as well, well, in some sense, it arises as being literally a gauge symmetry of these equations in the sense that you transform them in some way without changing any physical data. So in it's just some symmetry, but this one in particular, this sort of adding linear combinations to some other cues, has just historically gotten the name gauge symmetry.
Because it looks like just changing the basis of solutions.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, of course, geometrically, if you look at this, it's just literally changing a basis. Yeah. But indeed, somehow the name gauge symmetry has stuck. At the end of the day, symmetry. OK. So now we'll do explicit solution. OK, so let's take length 2. So now we have two particles on the chain, each sitting in the spin 1/2 representation of SU2, which decompose into a symmetric representation and a singlet. OK, so this thing has spin 1. This thing has spin 0. And what do the eigenstates actually look like? So we said already that we have some vacuum state in the spin chain whose eigenvalue was L over 2. And because L is 1, sorry, L is 2, This is just equal to 1. So we know that this state should correspond to the highest weight state of the symmetric representation. Why do I know it's the highest weight state? Because it's killed by my spin raising operator, because as I wrote on like whatever board it was, this state was constructed from this was just a state with all spins up. So if I act with a raising operator to raise spins, I can't, so I get 0. This is why it's highest weight. And what about this guy? So this guy is the usual anti-symmetric representation. Which is just 0. And so of course I know that this is this state.
Sir, I have a question. So you say that it's highest weight vector for like from the spin 1 representation?
Yes.
But it also have sigma z equal to 0. Or it's equal to 1. Sorry.
Yes, indeed, it's equal to 1, yes.
Sir.
You have a typo there. The second spin is now.
Thank you. Yes. Okay, so now we're going to solve the QQ system for these two irreducible representations and read off the corresponding Hamiltonian energy eigenvalue. So this state was just the original vacuum state. So S is just 0 for this, right? No spins are flipped. Whereas this thing is a linear combination of states where one spin has been flipped, so S is equal to 1. And so based on what I told you, that these Q functions should have asymptotics related to the number of spins flipped in this way, I know that for this solution, I should have Q1 of U is just A1, because it's a polynomial of degree 0. And Q2 should be a polynomial of degree 3. Right, so L is 2, plus 1 is 3, minus S, which is 0. Whereas for this solution, Q1 of U is polynomial of degree 1. And Q2 will be polynomial of degree 2. OK, so I'm not going to do both of them because the first one, well, is slightly complicated. Well, not complicated, but more involved because I need to deal with polynomial of degree 3. But we can do the second one super explicitly. OK, I guess this one can now disappear. And that's rear. Are there questions at this point? Okay, so we'll do this representation. So we know that Q1 is a polynomial of degree 1. So let's write it as u minus u1, where u is the root of this polynomial. And q2 of u is a2 u squared plus little a u plus b. Okay, so if we just plug these things into this equation and try to solve, we will not get a unique solution. To actually get a unique solution, we need to fix these symmetries, which we have. So the first symmetry I want to use is this rescaling symmetry. So this one, where I can multiply q1 by some constant c, and I can multiply q2 by some constant 1 over c. Okay. So by using this rescaling symmetry, I can fix this constant a1 to be just 1. Right? I just choose c to be 1 over a1. So by symmetries, I can fix a1 to be just 1. Okay. But now we also have this so-called gauge symmetry. So we can send q2 to, in this case, what I want to do is send q2 to q2 minus a q1. Why do I want to do this? Because of fixing this symmetry, so q1 is just u minus u1. Now, if I subtract from q2 a times q1, I'm subtracting a times u, which cancels with the a u in q2, which means that I can use this gauge symmetry to kill or set this a1 to be equal to 0. So now q2 is just a2 u squared plus b. Okay, so now we can solve. And for most practical purposes, at least which will be relevant for the case of n equals 4 super Young Mills, the way to do this would be to take these q's, plug in their large u expansion into this relation, this QQ relation, wherever I wrote it, which, by the way, in this case, to write the full thing explicitly, is just U to the L equals Q1 of U plus I over 2, Q2 of U minus I over 2, minus Q2 of U plus I over 2, Q1 of U minus I over 2. I just take this relation, I plug in the ansatz for these functions. Q1 is u minus u1, q2 is a2 times u squared plus b. Plug into this relation, fix coefficients of u at each power on both sides, and you get a unique solution. And so what you find is this a2 just I u1 is 0, and b is I over 4. Okay? So you found these q functions, you plugged them into the formula for the energy. So the energy was given by minus I over 2 times the log derivative of q1 plus over q2 minus. And you find the energy is minus 2. And please don't become scared by the fact that the energy is negative. It's simply a consequence of the fact that we did an overall energy shift to make this highest weight vector we started from to have energy 0.
why a large U expansion?
So in the case of n equals 4 super Young Mills, we know these Q functions explicitly asymptotically. And the idea is to start using these relations to start shifting, because these are finite difference equations. So you give me a solution valid at large U, I can now start using these relations to shift the function down, 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 down to say finite value. Of course, here it doesn't matter because everybody is polynomial. So you just fix coefficients of U for each power of U on both sides. But if I was to do something more complicated where I'm not dealing with polynomials, this is what I would do. Just take large U expansion, fix to some finite order, and then see what happens.
And another question, how do you know that the symmetries are going to like fix everything until you have a unique solution? Like, what is the physical meaning of that?
Well, physical meaning, well, physically it just means I have some system which has some manifest symmetry, and then I fix my symmetries, and then my solution should be unique, assuming I have a well-posed like physical problem. Here, of course, I mean, the physical nature of this is not necessarily clear, but I mean, the answer to most of these questions is related to, if you construct these things as operators, you see that once these particular symmetries are fixed, you should get a unique solution. More questions?
I'm trying to understand how can I understand this degree Q1 and Q2. Is it like true for this I go for U to infinity and then there I will see the degrees of like that?
So you mean you want to understand why this is the asymptotic of Q2?
Yeah, why is it?
So the initial input is that both of these things should be polynomial. So once they're polynomial, I fix the degree of one of them. I just call one of them degree s. So now I want to know why the second one should have degree l minus s plus 1. So this is quite easy. We just need to plug these things into the defining relation, which is just written up here. So let's look at this relation asymptotically at large u. So on the left-hand side, we have u to the l. And on the right-hand side, so we should have a1 and then u plus I over 2 to the power s at the leading order, like at large u. And then whatever this power here should be, let's just say call it c times a2 minus, again, a1. A2 u minus I over 2 to the s, and then u plus I over 2 to the c. So we know that at large u, the left-hand side must be equal to u to the l, okay? But because of this anti-symmetry, at the leading order here, we'll have a1, a2, so leading order is actually going to cancel. So we have u to the s plus c minus u to the s plus c, because at the leading order in large u, the shifts are not going to contribute, minus the subleading, which will be something like u to the s plus c minus 1, and then some non-trivial term. So this is, of course, just 0. And then for this thing to make sense, we know that this should be equal to u to the l, which means that c should be equal to l plus 1 minus s. And this fixes the degree. Is it clear? OK. More questions?
So how do you write down the wave function at the level of spin string?
Wave function? So you mean explicit physical eigenvector of Hamiltonian?
Yeah.
This is, in some sense, something that would require an extra lecture by itself. Which, to some extent, Pedro will do in his final talk.
But this gadget is useful for eigenvalues.
I'm sorry?
this is useful for a spectrum.
This is useful for spectrum, but it is also useful for eigenvector. But the problem is, me answering that question requires introducing a completely different or a completely new level of technology. But the point is, and the point of view of everything that's sort of what we do, is that there exists a special basis in the spin chain Hilbert space, which we call separated variable basis, where the wave function is given by literally product of these q's. So you could imagine these q's as being in a special basis of the Hilbert space, one particle wave functions. And then when you go to this basis, the full Hamiltonian eigenstate will factorize into just one particle products of these individual wave functions. Any more questions? Okay. So now let's try to make some more contact with Pedro's talk and derive this Baxter equation. So what's good to kill? Probably this. And then rear needs to go to the front. Was there anything? Have I done something wrong? I feel like I'm missing.
The back one.
I tried to do that, but.
Thanks.
Oh, okay. I didn't scroll all the way. Okay, perfect. Thanks. Okay.
Paul, I have a question. So here you consider a system of length 2.
Yes.
So you have a certain number of parameters to determine.
Yes.
Of constant determine, and but you always have one equation. Now, if you would consider, still SU2, but longer chain.
Yes.
You still have only one equation, right?
No, I have many equations.
Depending on the representation or the length of the spin chain.
Yes.
Which
one? I misunderstood about you. Well, depending on the length of the spin chain and depending on the representation, yes. Because if I go to, and this is what I'm going to show, so if I go to higher representations, first of all, the degree of the left-hand side is going to change. But now I cannot, but I mean, so first of all, degree changes, but also these Q functions should be understood as, okay, if I fix the degree, then I have many equations related to the expansion in U, and each coefficient of U gives me an equation. So the fact that I go to higher length is not going to be a problem.
Yeah. But if you change the representation inside SU2, also would be the same structure.
Sorry, if I what?
Your QQ problem would look like the same if you consider higher spin representation in the side of your chain.
Yes. Yeah.
So only increasing the rank, then you would get a more complicated system.
Yes. Yes, that's correct. Yes. Yeah, so for anything which is like SL2, SU2, or anything like this, it's exactly this single equation. Even, for example, these like principal series representations that you were looking at, then you have exactly this relation.
So you immediately get all the charges of the spin chain.
Yes.
Looking just at this equation.
Yes, exactly. Yes. And this is in some sense why quantum spectral curve is so powerful, especially if you look at n=4 super Young Mills. You have just this single equation, finite difference equation, instead of some infinitely many coupled integrals equations of y functions and TBA kernels and so on. Yes, okay. So in that sort of essence of that question, I will change the structure of how I want to do this slightly and consider the case of instead of spin 1/2, spin minus 1/2. So analytically continue in spin and then set spin to minus 1/2. Okay? Okay. because this is actually the class of representations which Pedro was considering. So spin minus 1/2. So now, of course, if we look at the physical spin chain picture, we no longer just have spin up and down on each spin chain site, but instead we're looking at some highest weight representation where we have an infinite number of possible states on each, or state configurations on each spin chain site. Okay? But from the point of view of this QQ system story, very little changes. All that changes is, so we still have Q1 of U plus I over 2, Q2 of U minus I over 2, minus Q1 of U minus I over 2, Q2 of U plus I over 2 equals 1 over U to the L. This is the only thing which changes. But now, of course, the analytic structure should also change to compensate for this, right? Because, of course, there is no way I can choose both Q1 and Q2 to be polynomials to give me this 1 over U to the L on the right-hand side, okay? But the best you can do is say, Q1 of U is polynomial, and Q2 of U should be something else. And of course, you look at this and you try to solve this finite difference equation. For example, you take, so the asymptotic structure is the same. Q1 will still be some U to the S, and then Q2 will be whatever we had before. So still, Q1 will be U to the S. Q2 will be U to the L plus 1 minus S. And you try to solve this relation asymptotically, like I said, by expanding in 1 over U. You'll find, of course, that this thing cannot be polynomial, but instead this Q2 has an infinite number of poles in the complex plane.
You want minus L.
Yes. Thank you. So Q2 now has this structure. So this is the complex plane. And now it starts to have an infinite number of poles in the lower half plane. So minus I over 2, minus 3i over 2, and so on. And so the fact that we're dealing with poles is sort of a manifestation of the fact that we're looking at, one loop at n equals 4 super Young Mills, as we'll see, and we'll see the precise mapping between this and full n equals 4 in the next lecture. But poles is sort of a zero coupling phenomenon. When we go to finite coupling, what essentially happens is these poles sort of stretch out and become cuts in the complex plane, which makes for some very interesting analytic structure. But for the moment, we just have poles. So now let's derive this Baxter equation from Pedro's talk. So middle should go away. Okay, so let's do the following thing. Let's write down a trivial relation. So I take a determinant, say QA, where A is some index, which is either going to be 1 or 2, because I have two of these Q functions. And now I have Q1 of U plus I, Q1 of U, Q1 of U minus I, and Q2 of U plus I, Q2 of U, and Q2 of U minus I. And for A equal to 1 or 2, this is trivially 0, just by the antisymmetry of the determinant. Okay. And to make a slightly controversial statement, but I think many people will agree with me, is that all of integrability is based on this trivial determinant. Okay? Even quantum spectral curve for n equals 4 super Young Mills can be written as just this stupid trivial statement. With extra details, of course. Okay? So let's take this determinant and let's expand it out. And I'll use some shorthand notation to avoid having anything completely massive. So we have QA of U plus I. Okay, so I'm just doing usual cofactor expansion of my determinant. So QA of U plus I, and now I have this sub-determinant here, which I'm just going to call D1, okay? So D1 of U minus QA of U, and now another 2x2 determinant D2, right? So my D2 is Q1 of U plus I times Q2 of U minus I minus Q1 of U minus I times Q2 of U plus I. And then plus the final term, which is QA of U minus I times another trivial determinant, D3 of U, and this is equal to 0 for A equal to 1 or 2. Okay, so this is a finite difference equation on these two Q functions, Q1 and Q2. So now let's see exactly what these things work out to be. So this D1, okay? So it's Q1 of U times Q2 of U minus I, and then minus antisymmetrize 1 with 2, just to save some time. But we know exactly what this is because this is just one part of our QQ relations, right? So QQ relations said that, so if I do this SU2 compact case, U to the L was equal to Q1 of U plus I over 2 times Q2 of U minus I over 2. So this relation is actually just the defining QQ relation shifted by I over 2. So in fact, is U minus I over 2 to the power L. Okay? And this other determinant, D3, is essentially just the exact same thing, but shifted in the opposite direction. So now it's Q1 of U plus I times Q2 of U minus antisymmetrize 1 with 2. And we read off from this QQ relation that this is just U plus I over 2 to the power L. So this was for this spin 1/2 case. If we did this spin minus 1/2 case, so this is spin 1/2. Okay, so all in all, I. And then a final determinant, I'm just going to call D2 T of U So this T was just a relabeling of this middle determinant D2. But in fact, one can show, again, as a consequence, which I won't do due to time, as a consequence of these QQ relations is, in fact, a polynomial and coincides exactly with the transfer matrix of Pedro. So this is the Baxter equation. So this is for compact spin 1/2 representation. If you analytically continue to spin, say, spin minus 1/2, which was the case of Pedro, then you would actually change some signs here. And why does this SL2 sector discussed by Pedro of n equals 4 super Young Mills correspond to an SL2 spin chain? Because we take these complex scalars, we insert these covariant derivatives, but we can insert as many covariant derivatives as we like. So if it's not compact, it's non-compact, we can insert an infinite number of covariant derivatives. So these insertions of covariant derivatives are like flipping spins. So we can do this infinitely many times in some SL2 spin chain. Okay, and the final thing, why is this thing called quantum spectral curve?
So spin minus 1/2 is like SL2?
Yes, it's SL2, yeah. Or in some other notation is also called like SU 1 comma 1. But yes, it's SL2. It's highest weight representation of SL2. Okay, so I should, yeah, that can go. So, final thing, which will just take 5 minutes, don't worry. Why quantum spectral curve? Why is it called this? So, in classical integrability, at least in the sense of Liouville integrability, we write down equations of motion in some sort of lax representation. So there is some matrix L, which depends on, of course, phase space coordinates and some complex variable U, spectral parameter as before, whose equations of motion can be written in this form with some auxiliary matrix M. Okay, so the point of this is that the spectral invariance of this matrix, so for example, its trace of L is equal to 0. So the trace of this matrix is conserved in time, just because when I take the trace of the commutator, I trivially get 0. So just to make this totally clear, this is equations of motion. And classically, there is a very well formulated in universal notion of classical spectral curve. Which is just given by the, well, eigenvalue equation of this Lax matrix. So we have the determinant, let's say lambda minus L generates these spectral invariants. So we have lambda squared minus trace of L lambda plus determinant of L. Okay, so this is classically. Now, when we quantize, and this is sort of a special property of integrable systems based on sort of the quantum algebras that people are familiar with, how exactly this quantization should look like. But in practice, what happens is, so still determinant of lambda minus, and now this L, which initially was functions on phase space, become promoted to operators acting on the Hilbert space of our system. But one extra ingredient, which is usually called D, and D is some differential operator, depending on the system under consideration. So for the SU2 or SL2 or any actual spin chain based on SLN or any of these things, this is actually a shift operator. So E to the I du. So this now becomes some finite difference operator, which acts on some functions and kills them. And the whole point is that once you do this quantization, the actual things this difference operator kills are precisely the Q functions. So if you imagine that this classical spectral curve gives you something a bit like the usual energy eigenvalue condition that Hamiltonian equals energy, when you quantize this, you get some Schrodinger equation acting on your wave functions, then this should be interpreted as the corresponding analog in the integrable spin chain. And so the reason we say that these Qs form a quantum spectral curve is precisely because they are naturally the wave function analogs of the classical spectral curve.
What was the U in the classical picture? Was it a configuration space?
The U?
Yeah.
So the U, you mean this U? It's again just a complex variable. The point is the equations of motion of this classical system will depend on some parameter U. The point is I have some, in general, complicated system with many equations of motion, and this parameter sort of repackages them into some nice configuration.
So you would have that type of picture also for n equals to 4?
This type of thing?
Yeah.
I wouldn't shake my head so quickly. So it is not completely understood what this thing is. Of course, we have classical spectral curve in n equals 4 super Young Mills, right? You take monotermic matrix, which is path ordered exponential of Black's connection, you can build this thing. So this picture exists at weak coupling, where you have the SU2 excess spin chain. This picture exists, or this thing exists at large volume, when you're dealing with something like one-dimensional Hubbard model or two copies, whatever you want. But whether literally this equation holds for n equals 4 at finite coupling is not completely clear. I suspect it does.
Well, it's not even completely clear what does it mean determinant there, right? There should be a prescription, so.
Sure. Okay, sure. At least in this case, column ordered determinant.
Yeah, somehow.
But yeah, of course, you're absolutely right. So the general, like, going slightly off topic because the question was asked. So in general, the way to understand, this is sort of a general thing that you can write for a class of matrices with non-commutative entries called Manin matrices. And the question is, if you consider n equals 4 super Young Mills, say, semi-classically at one loop in a string quantization, does this Manin structure persist? If it does, this holds. But no one has done that yet. No one has checked. But I suspect there is something like this. Maybe this needs to be understood in some generalized sense, but I suspect there is something like this. Any more questions? Yes.
Can you explain again what is the parameter U? Like, it is a parameter in the configuration space, in the phase space?
No, it's an auxiliary parameter. So it's not a physical parameter. It's not like it's momenta or coordinates or physical coordinates of the classical picture. It's just an auxiliary parameter. So if you consider a classical spin chain, where now you're no longer dealing with finite dimensional matrices acting on a Hilbert space, but say some representation of SL2 acting on a phase space, where, for example, now say your raising operator is actually something like PQ or PQ squared or something like this, the usual type of picture that you would have, then all this parameter U does is sort of repackage all of the integrals of motion into a convenient generating function. It's just a way of repackaging complicated objects into something simple.
I think the confusion is the equations of motion. The way you write it, it looks like you are saying that this is the equations of motion. Right? What you want to say is that L has some auxiliary parameter.
Yes.
This equation being satisfied for any auxiliary parameter implies many equations, including
yes.
the equations of motion.
Yes.
So so that equation there, L dot equal Lm, is not the equation of motion that follows from Lagrange. And it's just an equation that, in particular, contains the equation of motion inside.
Yes, exactly. Yes. OK, so
okay.
I'm finished. So thank you very much.
I have a very quick technical question.
Mm-hmm.
For the energy, is the energy invariant under the gauge symmetry that you mentioned, that you called gauge symmetry? Is the energy for computer, you said Q1 and Q2, I could use either of them. Can I
yes.
use a combination of Q1 and Q2?
Yes.
Okay.
Of course, depending on the exact physical thing that you look at, you might want to be careful with how you do this. So this is exactly what happens when you look at, say, complex spin. Then you would want to take some particular, I mean, if you just plug in these things, because these things have an infinite number of poles, you plug these things in, you can get some divergences. You want to consider some combination which regularizes the energy.
But then the answer is no. It's the opposite of what I said. What you said. You said yes, but then your explanation was no.
So under the assumption that all Qs are on the same footing, then yes. When I have this gauge symmetry, then the answer is yes. When Q2 and Q2, both polynomials, nobody cares which one I use, the answer for the energy is exactly the same. When I go to...
Can I also use Q1 plus 5 Q2?
Sure.
And I get the same energy.
Yes.
Okay.
The only problem that... The scenario I gave where the answer contradicted my actual statement was when the case where this gauge symmetry is not really a symmetry, where Q1 is polynomial, but Q2 is some very complicated guy with many poles. Then, of course, they're no longer on equal footing. They're very different analytically. Yes?
Well, for example, SL2 at integer spin.
SU2?
SL2 at integer spin.
SL2 at integer spin. So you still want to have some infinite dimensional representation, or? Oh, but you mean minus integer spin then? Like, well, minus, like say, spin minus 5 or something like this. Or what do you mean? I mean, if I consider SL2.
SL2 for polynomial Q1, I'll have no polynomial Q2 for my HL, right?
Well, how large are we talking? I mean, if you want to.
Actually, for any L. Q2 is not polynomial, even for.
You mean in this setup with spin minus 1/2?
Yes.
Or, then yes, indeed, Q2 is not polynomial.
But is there a prescription to get the energy from Q2 at integer spin that breaks down at complex spin? Or?
As far as I'm aware, if you have, in the situation where Q2 is polynomial, you'll still have issues extracting the energy from Q2. Sort of related to this question of wave functions, if we look at something which is non-compact and we try to compute the eigenfunctions using the non-polynomial Q, we sort of immediately run into some troubles. Even for if we take like spin minus 1, spin minus 1/2, or something like this. But if you take totally complexified spin, then you should, where nobody is polynomial, then you would really want to start like taking some good linear combination, which makes energy finite. But this I will do in the third talk.
Okay, so let's thank Paul again.